Okay, I'd like to introduce Chris Gilliard, who is going to be talking on aging well in the Renaissance, which is slightly different from Renaissance treatises in aging well.
Thank you very much. This is kind of going back in time to what it could be loosely called the sort of era of pre-scientific medicine, and where the kind of dilemmas that Sharon has been identifying didn't exist, but where similar desires did, i.e. the desire for a longer life, and a healthier life, and a better life. And what I'd like to focus on is a particular period when the idea of old age as a desirable stage of life, one that could be lived well, emerged. Now, this is not to say that there have never been previous attempts to extend life, to rejuvenate an aging body and so on. But what I think is kind of particularly distinctive about the period that I'm talking about, which is essentially late 15th, 16th century, is the expansion of literature concerned with the idea of aging well. In many accounts of the sort of, what's the history of gerontology, two books are highlighted as illustrating what writers have called the precursors of gerontology. The first one, which tends to be one that's mentioned perhaps more in histories of geriatrics, i.e. treatment of age, is Gabriel Zerbe's Gerontocomia, which was written in 1489. And the one that is probably kind of cited more often in more general accounts about gerontology is Luigi Cornaro's Discourse on a Temperate Life, which was written some 50, 60 years later. But both of these books have been used as points of reference in accounts of the history of the study of or the treatment of old age. What I'd like to do this afternoon is first of all consider why this should have happened. Why were these books written at the time? And what was their audience? What was their intent? But I'd also like to kind of try and cover some of the key themes within the books. The two authors that I am starting off with, one was an academic medic who followed the scholastic tradition, citing all the appropriate authors like Hippocrates and Galen, Celsus, and so on. And the second and later writer was essentially a patrician who was caught up with what has been described as the civic humanism of the Renaissance, the idea of what constitutes a good life, what constitutes virtue, what constitutes a well-run state, and says what kind of society and what kind of people should there be. And the idea that to gain a point of reference for that, it was important to return to the writings of classical Greece and Rome. So this is a sort of, I guess, that sort of civic humanist tradition. The second point, which is also important, is that following the plagues of the 14th century, the Italian city-states were perhaps unique in developing an explicit public health agenda. They had instituted a public health board, and they required there to be medical doctors to be on that board, not to control the board. The board was controlled by senators and senior civic officials, but doctors were on that board, and also the doctors were also employed to provide and deliver public health, to work in the public hospitals. And when travellers from the rest of Europe visited Italy in the 15th century, one of the things that struck them most was the existence of hospitals, not as essentially religious institutions offering, if you like, welfare to passers-by and travellers and the poor, but institutions which were organised and laid out specifically with the idea of addressing the needs of sick people and treating sickness. And most of the public health doctors of the Italian city-states were academic doctors. They weren't, if you like the poor law doctors that emerged in the sort of 18th and 19th centuries in Europe, the kind of the bottom of the barrel, as it were. But these were professors of medicine, people who were appointed to the faculties of medicine, the schools of medicine, and who also worked for the public health good. So the second point about, I guess, this sort of period and this time and this setting was a very explicit agenda about improving the public health of the state, the civitatis, the city-state. And the third point, which is also important, was that the Renaissance was a period of, certainly in Italy, a period of considerable generational conflict between, if you like, what was seen as the parties of the old men and the parties of the youth. And this political conflict, which was very much to do with the way in which the city-state should be governed and the role of, if you like, the prince versus the Senate in terms of controlling what happened, was reenacted in the plays and the literature at the time. So there was an awful lot of going back in part to the kind of classical tradition of plays that were kind of based upon Terence and Plautus, people like that, in Rome, but also continue reenacting this idea of, in a sense, a foolish old man and a sensible old man and their children and behaving appropriate or inappropriate to their children. So the issue about generational relationships was particularly salient, and old age was capable of being mocked. But at the same time, what was also a feature of that period was that the ruling elite were largely older people. And this was particularly the case in a city-state like Venice, where you had to be old to be the doge, to be the leader of the council. And that there was this conflict between, if you like, a powerful ruling elite of older men, and at the same time, the notion of a society undergoing change. So the issue of, if you like, the virtues of old age was particularly important to the elite. The other point that I think is kind of worth using as a focus for understanding this literature is the relevance of Galen. And the fact that in the Middle Ages, the writings of Galen had been, by and large, accessed through the mediation of the translators who had taken Galen within the sort of expanding Muslim empire, translated him into Arabic, and had produced, if like, synopses and commentaries on Galen's text. But in the 14th and 15th century, there was increasing access to Galen's original writings and the whole corpus of his writings in both Greek and Latin. This is an illustration of the first complete set of works published in Greek in Venice in the early 16th century, and a decade later published in both Latin and Greek. What was important in Galen as a point of reference was his approach towards the idea of aging and old age. Galen wrote a treatise called De Marasmo about the idea of decay. And he described aging as a process of corruption, a kind of complex kind of marasmus that involved both a process of cooling and a process of drying out. And he took various positions in relation to how should aging and old age be viewed. Should it be viewed as a sickness? Should it be viewed as a state of alterable health? Is it something natural? Is it unnatural? Or is it something in between? And his conclusion, in many ways, acted as the point of reference for a lot of the writing on hygiene that emerged in the Renaissance. The idea that it is impossible to prevent it, but it is possible to help extend the length of life. In other words, that Galen didn't believe that it was possible to create immortality, but at the same time he didn't believe that there was some sort of fixed limit, and therefore it was a justifiable intervention on the part of doctors to try and both extend life and also to improve the health of individuals at all stages of life. So in some ways he gave the green light to justify, if you like, the rational medical scholar to approach the issue of aging. And this was an important reference for the hygienists of the Renaissance. Old age was certainly not unknown, and there was a marked shift from the